Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What are the most important events in world history? Even if it's been decades since we studied it in high school or college, most Americans can call to mind the birth of civilization in the Fertile Crescent, the classical age of Greece and the domination of the Roman Empire, the Renaissance, the Enlightenment, and the democratic, industrial, and technological revolutions. But while these events are indeed critical moments in Western history, they don't match up exactly with the formative events of the Islamic world. And my guest this hour believes that disconnect goes a long way toward explaining what to many people feels like a clash of civilizations in the modern world. Author Tamim Ansari is director of the San Francisco Writers' Workshop. His new book is called Destiny Disrupted, A History of the World Through Islamic Eyes. Tamim, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
So you see some of our intercultural differences not as a clash of civilizations, so much as an intersection of sort of two separate world histories. Can you talk about that?
The thesis that I argue in my book, Destiny Disrupted, is that if you think of the Islamic world as being the heart of the world and its history as being the history of the world, which many people in that part of the world did for many centuries, then that world has a momentum and had a momentum, and that world and the Western world were more or less oblivious to each other until about someplace between 1600 and 1800. And it was during that period that the West expanded and permeated the Muslim world, and the momentum of its history kind of overwhelmed the momentum of the Islamic world's history. But that other overwhelmed stream of history didn't just disappear. It became something like a riptide that continues under the surface, and there's an argument going on amongst Muslims themselves about how to deal with this competing current. And that's what I think is partly going on in the world today.
And we're not even simply talking about different events that have been highlighted. It's as fundamental as dating the world and its history with entirely different years.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you're in the Islamic world, the pivotal moment of history, the moment that divides all of time into before and after, is not, for example, the birth of Christ. It's the moment when Prophet Muhammad moved from Mecca to Medina. And that's everything after that is after the Hijra, and everything before that is before the Hijra. So that's that would be seen as the pivotal moment of history. And then what you would think of as the Dark Ages from the Western perspective is actually the Bright Ages, because that's the period in which Islamic civilization really began to flourish and came to one of its peaks.
And even the terminology Middle East isn't really relevant there. It's the Middle World by Islamic reckoning.
Yeah, well, you know, the Middle East, if you're standing in Iran, is somewhere west of you. So that's an anomaly that you have to deal with. And one of the things that that I argue or point out in this book is that whole region from about, you know, Asia Minor, Istanbul, the eastern Mediterranean, across Iraq, across Iran, across Afghanistan, north into the Central Asian Republic, south into Pakistan and across part of India, that whole region was interconnected and sort of knew of one another and therefore had something like a shared world narrative. And I think it's interesting that when we discuss that part of the world in the West, we don't have a single name for it. The Middle East only refers to a little sliver of that world. And so in my book, I've just sort of coined the word, and I call it the Middle World, because it's in the middle between Western civilization and the Chinese-dominated world.
So your awareness of these two differing narratives came really at an early age when you met the celebrated historian Arnold Toynbee. Can you talk about that?
Well, you know, I was born and raised in Afghanistan, and of course, therefore, going to school in Afghanistan, I was exposed to world history from a different perspective than the one that you would routinely hear if you were an American school child. But the books that were available to me to read for fun, the more entertaining books, and I loved history from the time I was a little child, were books written in English. And when I was about 9 or 10, I was living in a town called Lashkargah, which is in the Helmand province, often in the news now. And the historian Arnold Toynbee was on a journey someplace. He stopped there. He heard that there was some little Afghan kid that liked history there. So he invited me to have tea with him. And after we had tea, he gave me a book, and the book he gave me was Hendrik Willem van Loon's The Story of Mankind, which is one of those wonderful, entertainingly written, comprehensive histories of the world. And it maps out the history of the world that's familiar to us, which follows the Western civilizational route. And that history then kind of became my stencil for world history, as it is for many people. I would say that, however, you know, maybe 40 years later, when I was a textbook editor and was working on a table of contents for a new high school world history, and starting from scratch as we did, it prompted me to think about what is the shape of the whole narrative. And what I discovered was that someplace in me there was a sense of an importance to the Islamic world that most of my advisors and curriculum specialists and history teachers and scholars didn't really share. And I think it was in the course of trying to hammer out, for example, how many chapters should be devoted to various aspects of Islamic civilization, that I really became aware that the consensus idea of the history curriculum in the United States assigned a much smaller role to Islam than I guess I saw Islam as having. And this, we were working on this book in late 2000 and early 2001. So this was pre 9/11, and to some small extent at that time, textbook industry was starting to say maybe there should be more coverage of Islam. But I think the question really came much more intensely to the fore after 9/11. I haven't been in the textbook industry since then, so I'm not exactly in touch with how the history textbooks have changed. I don't think they've really changed that much, though.
So both cultures sort of start world history with the rise of complex civilization in Mesopotamia. But maybe you can talk about the takeaway messages in the Islamic world from that period that we don't focus on in the West.
Well, I would say that, you know, starting from Mesopotamia, where you would go after that from the middle world perspective would be the great Persian empires. And there was a succession of them. You know, there was the Persian Empire, then the Parthian Empire more or less occupied that same core area, then there was the Sassanid Empire. And these were a succession of great empires that had the same kind of importance in that part of the world that Rome had further west. And in fact, you know, Rome didn't expand further east than it did because there was this complex, powerful, you know, entity sitting there with its core in more or less Iran. Then if you go on to the next stage, once Islam was born, it expanded with amazing rapidity. You know, it expanded into Egypt, but mostly it expanded east of that point, and it expanded across what had been the Sassanid Empire, took all of that, went into Afghanistan. And I would say that that expansion happened because there was lines of communication, lines of permeation of information and ideas already existed. There was a network of what I like to call, you know, civilizational capillaries. The blood of civilization flowed easily in that direction. And when Islam expanded over there, it's because ideas were easily able to permeate across that whole territory. And then what had been what I'm calling the middle world, then became pretty much the Islamic world. And from that point on, there was a period in which the Islamic Khalifat, you know, the single political entity, which also was the world of Islam, that was in that part of the world, again, something like Rome in its the importance of Rome as a founding moment in Western civilization, that great Khalifat was the empire to which later people would look back and say, okay, there was a time when there was a universal empire.
So before we talk more about the earliest days of Islam, we should point out that you're telling these stories from the perspective of what people in the Middle East believe, because they're looking at these moments not simply as sort of allegorical examples of how their faith came about, but as moments of historical fact. Why is it so important for us to take that into account?
I think maybe I would go back to the fact that... My book is laid out in such a way that there is a 60-year period which is covered at great length. Many pages are devoted to a 60-year period that begins in about 610 when Prophet Muhammad received his revelation in the cave, through to the time when his fourth successor finally was assassinated and a political empire succeeded it. So those 60 years in which the story is intensely focused on individuals, it's like a passionate, intense, dramatic, people-oriented story. Many of the issues that then became themes of world history originated in that almost family drama. You know, the original community in Medina was so small that we know the names of all the people that were that were involved in that, and the iconic early battles of Islamic history, which came to have profound theological meaning, were in fact such small clashes that we know the names of all the people who died in those. It's important to realize that, for example, unlike the life of Buddha that's shrouded in myth, and to some extent, you know, also even the central drama, the core drama of Christianity, this event in Mecca, Medina, and then the subsequent expansion is much more historically known. It was prolifically recorded and recounted, and when Muslims look back to that, they don't look at it as parables. They look at it as events that actually happen. And when they look back at that that original community in Medina that Prophet Muhammad presided over, they think of it as a perfection that actually existed in history, not an ideal vision of something that might someday exist in the future.
Well, excuse me for interrupting. When you say it's prolifically recorded, unlike Christianity, it was being recorded at the moment it was happening. It wasn't a couple of hundred years later that people sat down and said, we should really put this on paper.
Well, yes and no. You know, it was. It's interesting to note, my brother pointed this out to me, that when they first wrote down the Quran, I had assumed that they gathered all the written scraps in order to correct the people's memories of what Muhammad had said. But in fact, in that time and place, it was the oral, people who I'm going to use the word storyteller, but, you know, the oral storytellers was the more trusted source. And what they were doing was comparing the written stuff against the people who were the reciters, the memorizers and reciters, to make sure that the written stuff was not inaccurate. So they corrected the writing against the memory of the reciters. Now, right from the beginning, within a few years of Muhammad's death, the people who succeeded him, they developed an institution, the people of the bench, the scholars, whose job it was to collect and cross-reference everything anybody remembered about what Muhammad had said or done. And to compile this as a body of knowledge, which could be used to make political decisions and to adjudicate law cases and decide matters of, you know, issues that came up. What we have as a record of that time is the written record of that time that we have comes from a couple of hundred years later, because the original documents somehow are lost. So the first time it was recorded in an edition that has survived to this day was the history of a man named Tabari, and that did come a couple of hundred years later.
Tamim Ansari is my guest. His new book is called Destiny Disrupted, A History of the World Through Islamic Eyes. We'll return to our conversation in a moment and welcome you to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you to get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin this summer. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Author Tamim Ansari is my guest. He is director of the San Francisco Writers Workshop, and his new book is called Destiny Disrupted, A History of the World Through Islamic Eyes. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. So, Tamim, from almost the moment of Muhammad's conversion, religious conversion, his ideas were that good people were obligated not simply to live as righteous individuals, but to build righteous communities. Can you talk about how that played itself out?
Yeah, well, first of all, I wouldn't call it religious conversion. You know, he experienced it as a revelation, a moment when God said, okay, you're the chosen mouthpiece. And Muhammad's own experience of that was that he had been selected to bring people back to the way. And so he continued to insist he wasn't inventing anything new. He was re-emphasizing what had already been known, you know, the Judaic tradition, the fact that there was only one God. That was his core message at first. It wasn't until he moved from Mecca to Medina, and he did that at the invitation of several tribes in Medina who said, would you come and be the arbitrator and preside over the whole community, because the tribes are quarreling, no one can get together, and we've heard that you're a guy who can settle these kinds of matters. So when he went to Medina, he went there as a community leader. And once he was there, he began building a Muslim community. And after he died, there was a moment when other parts of Arabia revolted against the community in Medina. And many of them said, we're still Muslims. We're still going to pray five times a day. We're still going to do all that. But we're not going to pay taxes to Medina. We're a different Muslim community. And the first successor of Muhammad said, no, that can't be done. You know, it's like the union is above everything else. There isn't just Muslim communities. There's only one Muslim community. There's the Muslim community, and you have to be part of it. You can't, you cannot secede. So they fought some wars in that first couple of years after Muhammad died, and the leadership at Medina prevailed. And from then on, to say the Muslim community meant there was that only that one Muslim community. That's a difference, I think, between the early Christian communities. You know, they didn't necessarily think they were obliged to be part of a single political entity. It was a way they lived, and different communities could be sovereign. So I think that put a stamp on the subsequent course of Muslim history. And then I think as time went along, and there was still, you know, this Khalifat idea was the idea that there was a leadership for the one Muslim community, and that was a political leadership which would create the conditions in which all people who wanted to live as Muslims would be able to do so easily. You know, in other words, if you're a Muslim, you need to pray five times a day at certain times. Well, the laws of the land that you lived in would not make that something that was difficult to do. And that was the idea of the expansion and why Muslims felt it was necessary to have a Muslim leader. And it was always the idea that if you lived in a place where the political leadership was not Islamic, and you found it difficult to live as a Muslim there, you should emigrate. You should do the hijra. You should go to a place where the laws of the land do favor being a Muslim. Now, what was the question again? Sorry.
I was talking about the fact that, yeah, that the community was also required to be righteous. It wasn't so much about you as an individual doing the right thing, but you wanted to do what was possible so that the entire community, and that's, I think, exactly what you just answered, lived in the right way. And from the beginning, Islam provided, as you mentioned, those laws, and the edicts were not always strictly what would seem to be religious from Western eyes. There were things that looked very much like legislation.
Yeah, I would say both of those things are true. You know, the Islamic Sharia, which is the code of conduct or something like that, you know, I'm translating loosely as to what the Sharia is. It's not only a code in the same sense that the legal code of any Western country is a code. It covers matters like contracts. It covers matters like what is a crime and what are the appropriate punishments for various crimes. So it's true that that's all part of the Sharia. but it's also true that the Sharia governs other aspects of daily living that we would not consider part of the legal system, you know, like how to brush your teeth or what kind of clothes to wear, or, you know, how to, you know, behave respectfully to your mother. So that the things that in some cultures would be considered religious or ethical conduct and the things that are considered legal or judicial matters, these are all part of one big system in Islam.
Tamim Ansari is my guest. His book is called Destiny Disrupted, A History of the World Through Islamic Eyes. Our number is 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Thomas in Dallas. Hey, Thomas.
Hi. Your subject is very interesting to me. Probably in studying Voltaire, I got some hints about this, because he talks a lot about it. There's some overlap in common law and some of Sharia that most people don't know. And, you know, much of Spain, all of our knowledge of Aristotle and all of that comes from Zayd ibn Rushd, a Muslim scholar. The first atheism, which I think is important in the Enlightenment, is most effectively propelled by Hume, but he said al-Ghazali in Iraq did that in the Muslim Islamic councils.
Yeah, that's right. You know, the knowledge of Aristotle that Europe had, curiously, came from the Arab Iranian or Arab Persian philosopher Ghazali, and he was actually intent on refuting Aristotle, but he felt that to be fair, before he refuted him, he should write a book that explained exactly what Aristotle said, so that then he would write another book that would refute that. And the book in which he explained exactly what Aristotle said is the book that made its way into Muslim Spain, got translated in Toledo, and then found its way into the libraries of Europe. And it was such a fair-minded, exposition of Aristotle's ideas that many people who were sort of groping for Aristotle would read that and say, oh, now I understand Aristotle. And there were people who read that in Europe and thought it was actually the work of Aristotle. And somehow the preface in which he explained that later he was going to refute all this dropped away. People in the Muslim world, the philosophers, were very, very interested in the Greeks. And originally they were interested in Plato, because Plato and the Neoplatonists that came after him propounded this idea that somehow all of creation is one. Reality, behind all of reality, is something they called the One. And Muslims looked at that and said, hey, this sounds just exactly like, what the core revelation of Islam is. There's only one God. And these guys are proving this with logic. So we could actually prove the Muslim revelations with logic. And they got interested in that. And they began figuring out how to reconcile Greek philosophy with Islamic theology. The translations of Greek philosophy that they injected into Europe, Europeans then picked up, and they got obsessed with figuring out how to reconcile Greek philosophy with Christian theology. And that led to a whole, school of scholastic philosophy in Europe.
How do Islamic historians frame the conflicts between the Persians and the Greeks?
You know, you're asking a question that has never occurred to me, and I don't really know, because the Muslim historians that I've read, like Ibn Khaldun, was the seminal philosopher of history. His discussion was mostly of events within the Islamic world, and he was looking for an explanation of the underlying engines of history, and he found it in his theory that history is a series of cycles in which nomads attack rich cities, become the rich citizens, and get attacked in turn by nomads. So I don't know if they would have fit the Greek thing into that. I think at the time, from the Middle World perspective, the Persians were considered the rich cultured civilization, and the Greeks were considered outlying, somewhat barbaric people that were supposed to make the gestures that showed that they had allegiance to the Persians and refused to do so.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Patrick in Richardson. Hey, Patrick.
Hello. I just want to tell you I love the show.
Thank
and
you.
The guest is super interesting. You know, it's funny, just before you brought me on, that was kind of my question. You know, that's a scary forebodance to think that history, as it applies to Islamic culture, could be applied to what's going on in Pakistan right now with what you just said about nomads attacking cities.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Listen, my question is I have a hard time understanding the dogma that within the Quran, what does it provide legitimacy for, the Shias, the Persians, or the Sunnis or the Arabs? Because right now in the world, it seems that Egypt and Saudi Arabia are aligning along the Arabesque route, and Iran and Hezbollah and Syria are aligning along the Persian route. And former Secretary of State Richard Armitage once said that the scary thing about Iran is that they have ideas of capitulating or regaining the strength they had back in this Persian empire you were just alluding to. So I want to know what you think about that.
Well, there is a continuity of some kind of coherent entity centered in what we now call Iran. The Persian Empire was long ago. That was pre-Islamic. But in the in the period from about 1500 to 1700, there was a revived, new, powerful imperial entity centered in what is now Iran, which was called the Safavi Empire. And that empire was, in fact, explicitly Shia. And they adopted Shiism, I think, from a historical perspective, you could say they adopted it as part of the calculated attempt to give the imperial rulers special legitimacy amongst the people they were ruling, the Persian people they were ruling, because Shiism was strong in that area, and also to set themselves apart from the other two Muslim empires on either side of them, the Ottomans on one side and the Mughals on the other side. But for that reason and for many other previous historical reasons, Shiism and Persianness have some kind of interassociation with each other. There is a history to that. But I think that when you come down to explaining what's going on, say in the Swat Valley and in Pakistan and the way things are lining up, you kind of have to follow the story all the way through. And there are many things that you can't explain strictly from. Even though Sunnis and Shias might line up on opposite sides of each other, you wouldn't be able to explain that by looking at Sunni doctrine and Shia doctrine and say, okay, they're fighting about this doctrine, because that's not the case. They're fighting because there was a trouble, 2 years ago, and that trouble broke out because there was trouble 2 years before that. So there's a kind of a historical continuity of trouble that if you don't resolve it somehow, it always comes back in another form, and that's part of the problem with, Israel-Palestine, that there's always some recent grievance that one side or the other feels needs to be expiated, and you can't really find the explanation for why there is the violence and the conflict strictly in the dogma.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have an email here from Rick in Dallas who asks, where does the Indian subcontinent and Southeast Asia fit into the history of the great civilization?
Well, I would say that, first of all, there is an Indian civilizational world. that's like the Middle World or the Chinese world. There is a world over there. And in the course of Islamic, the development of Islamic civilization, there was a period in which what had been nomadic Turkish tribes, this business of the nomads and the sedentary citizens once again rears its head in Islamic history. And the Turkish tribes began coming south and conquering. And from the Afghanistan region, there was a long series of conquerors, Turkish conquerors, who swept into India. And so northern India eventually came under Islamic rule. And during the Mughal civilization, roughly 1500 to 1750, let's say, during that period, Muslims were in control of much of India. And that, again, is two rivers of history sort of intersecting. And I think we see the unresolved consequences of that to this day as well. After British colonialism took over India, underneath the whole British thing, this Hindu-Muslim thing continued to develop, play itself out, and develop, you know, sort of new tensions. And then when the British left, they split the subcontinent, and the Muslim movement, which was a minority movement in India, felt like it would be threatened if India became a sovereign state and they were a Muslim minority in there. So they demanded their own state, and they became eventually Pakistan and Bangladesh.
Can you talk for a minute about the perceptions within the Islamic world of the Crusades when they happened?
Well, from what I was able to figure out, and I got a lot of this especially from a brilliant Lebanese writer, Amin Maalouf, who wrote a whole book called Crusades Through Arab Eyes. And, you know, the Christian Crusaders came in the spirit of clash of civilization. They came east specifically to kill Turkish infidels and wrest back the Holy Lands and put them in the rightful ownership of Christians. The Muslims who were living there and who ruled that area, before the Crusaders came, they didn't really see it as a clash of civilization, especially at first. They just felt like they were civilization, and this was not another civilization coming after them. This was like wild beasts from the forest. They didn't think of them as being very civilized. And they had no curiosity about what the Christians' ideas were. You know, they treated them purely as invaders. And now it's also important to realize that the Crusaders, even though that was a clash between Christian Europe and Muslim Middle World, all of that happened only in that narrow strip of the Eastern Mediterranean. And there is a lot of Muslim world east of that. And I would say that, the Crusaders never made it to Mecca or Medina. They never made it to Baghdad. And they certainly never even, no whisper of them came to Iran or beyond that. So actually, the Crusades didn't have much impact on the Muslim world at the time. Now it's been revived by Islamists who made something.
Tamim, I'm going to take a break later. Here. Tamim Ansari is my guest. Back in just a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you to get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin this summer. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Tamim Ansari. His new book is called Destiny Disrupted, A History of the World Through Islamic Eyes. We have an email here from John in Rockwall who points out that I misspoke when I mentioned that books of the Bible were not written until hundreds of years later. He is correct about this. Of course, they weren't assembled into the Bible until much later. But as John points out, Matthew, Mark, and Luke were all written within 30 years of the time of Christ. And I do appreciate his email with that correction. Thank you. I want to talk. We spoke a minute ago, Tamim, about the Crusades and how they were perceived, at least initially, in the Islamic world. It was sort of a different story when the Mongol invasions happened. Can you talk about those a little bit?
Yeah, I was going to say that the Crusades were almost immediately followed by a much, much bigger event for the Islamic world as a whole, which was the invasion of the Mongols from Mongolia that came sweeping across the Muslim world. And they massacred whole cities, and finally they burned down Baghdad, which had been the capital, the cultural capital of the Muslim world, and destroyed many libraries, and many manuscripts and records and archives went up in flames. So that was a moment that really marked the turning point in Muslim history. And one of the things that the Mongol Holocaust produced was a crisis for theologians in the Muslim world, because it was more or less the case that until that time, Islam had never known anything but relentless success and expansion. There might have been a little shrinkage here or something, but soon made up for by some other expansion someplace else. And up until that time, there had been sort of a doctrine among theologians that the success, the political and military success of Islam was a proof of its revelation, especially if you think of Islam as being the social project, this idea of universalizing a community of justice that's built according to these certain guidelines. So if success proved that the revelations were true, the question comes up for theologians, what does it mean for the revelations when Muslims have this tremendous setback? And one of the ideas that developed at that time was that, well, actually the defeat of Muslims indicates that we haven't been true to Islam. We've stopped being Muslims. And among the revivalist and reformist movements that developed then, there was a strong current of we have to go back and do it like they did in the in the 7th century. We have to rediscover exactly how Muhammad and his companions lived and go back to that. And this was an idea that was born in the shadow of the Mongol Holocaust, and it revived in the period when Muslims suddenly felt like they had lost their power in the face of European colonialism. And some of the revival and reformist movements that started up in response to this colonialism in the 1800s and into the 1900s are movements that are with us today. The descendants of them are some of these Islamists that are doing all these frightening things in parts of the world.
Let's go next to Gabriella in Las Colinas. Hey, Gabriella.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
I'm enjoying the show too much. I'm at work, and I need to ask my question real quick, but my question is this. I had mentioned, I had heard that your caller indicated that when he was 9 years old, he was reading, you know, history books and, you know, just enjoyed it so much. And I would like to know from him if he knows of any books or DVDs that would be good to introduce, like a five-year-old, to the history and geography of, and for lack of a better word, I'll use the Middle East, but oftentimes when I do sit with her and we talk about Afghanistan and Pakistan and we'll talk about India and we'll talk about, you know, Islam, sometimes that even I have a hard time trying to explain this to her, but if there was maybe something like a book that was child-orientated or, you know, at that level that would explain some of this history, I think that would be great. And I think we fail to really understand the importance of teaching that to our young people, and so that they can grow up with an appreciation as to what the development of the world, as we know it, it's not the way it used to be. I'll leave my question to that, and if he has any suggestions, I'd be more than happy to write them down and be able to research them.
Sure. Thanks, Gabriella. Any suggestions to me for making sure that
kids... Let me try to understand what the question was. She wanted to know who to read in order to get history of the Middle East.
Yes, and specifically so that she can teach her kids.
Specifically so she can teach her kids. So books written for young people.
Mm-hmm.
Gee, I myself wrote a book about Afghanistan that was for kids, for about fifth grade, that's still in the libraries. I think it's out of print, but many libraries have it. But so she could look at that. For kids, I don't know if I can tell her, because I've been researching for this book and I've read 100 books, but they're all for grown-ups, so to speak.
So maybe start with this book, which is a great primer, and then sort of communicate it to the kids and go from there.
Yeah, communicate it to the kids. You know, you could read my other book, West of Kabul, East of New York, in which I have fairly kind of simple explanations of issues in Islam. So that would be something. I wish I could help you out right off the bat, but I just hadn't thought of that at this moment. Sorry.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Imad in Arlington. Hi, Imad.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
And thank you very much for having different people with different perspectives on this. I wanted to start by saying that, as a comment, the title of the book, which is Destiny Disrupted, implies that Islam was born at the time of Muhammad, peace be upon him. And I wanted to share with you and the listeners that from a pure Muslim or Islamic perspective, this religion started back at the time of Adam onto Abraham, and there is no difference. The Quran speaks over and over about how the religion of Moses, Jesus, and Muhammad are all the same. And then my second comment is that you asked the author about how Islam frames the battles between Persians and the Persia and Roma. And I wanted to let you know that there's a chapter in the Quran called Al-Rum, which means the Rome. And it starts by saying, basically, today Rome lost against Persia, and the believers, i.e. the Muslims, are sad, but they will be happy when Roma wins again. So the Muslims basically lined up with Rome, because Rome believes in a god versus Persia, which did not have a god in the same way.
Yeah, thanks very much for your call, Imad. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Tamim, the point about this being a religion that predates Muhammad is one that you've already made, but perhaps you can comment on the relationship with Rome.
Actually, the original question was about Persians and Greeks. So mm-hmm. this Rome is a different thing. And what Muslims were referring to as Rome at this point is what historians call the Byzantine Empire, which in fact to themselves also was Rome at the time. They didn't think of themselves as something different. And so at some point, yeah, the Muslims lined up with the Byzantines against Persia, but then later they also went against the Byzantines. So that's all I can say. But yeah, as far as the religious doctrine goes, Islam was not something new. It was a revival of what had been there before, the Abrahamic tradition going back to going back to Adam.
You make the point in the book, actually, that although the Byzantine Empire was overwhelmingly Christian, it's sort of set aside by Western historians in comparison with the influence of the Roman Empire. Can you talk about the regional influence that Byzantium had at the time?
Byzantium was what Eastern, you know, East Rome split into an Eastern Empire and a Western Empire, and Byzantium is what later historians called the Eastern Roman Empire, and in that empire, Christianity took a special form in that the emperor was actually the head of the church, and that's not what happened in the West, of course. And so there was a kind of a secular and religious thing that was all combined in the Byzantine Empire. That Byzantine Empire ruled along the Eastern Mediterranean and into Egypt. And when the Muslims came along, the Muslim doctrine was that we're going to control this area politically, but all different religions can continue to practice their religion as they wish. And the Christians that were under Byzantine rule generally embraced the Muslims, because the Muslims said you have to pay a tax for being non-Muslim, but you can continue to practice your rights any way you want. Well, actually, the Byzantines also imposed a tax, and it was actually higher. And the Byzantines did care how the Christians in their empire conducted their rites, because they were Christians and they had ideas in the matter, whereas the Muslims felt like, well, if you're not a Muslim, we don't really care what your rights are, because they're all wrong. So until you come over to Islam, we have no interest in that.
And
so
rights in the sense of rituals in this case.
How's that?
When you say they didn't care about rights, you mean their rituals. They didn't care how they practiced Christianity.
They didn't care how exactly they practiced the rites and rituals of Christianity.
Right.
Yes.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. And let's go next to Ramsey in Arlington. Hey, Ramsey.
Yes, hi. I'm calling to ask about. I was raised in Egypt, which is a Muslim country, but I'm not Muslim. And one of the chilling things was that we were always taught that if you're a Muslim or convert to another religion, you can be killed without any penalty. And I'm wondering if that's an original part of Sharia, or is it something that came later, or just to... I'm wondering where this came from, and if it's widespread in the whole Arab world or only in Egypt.
My understanding is it came later, but not much later. Because it comes out of that period of the apostasy wars that were raging in the couple of years after Prophet Muhammad died, and it was when the other Muslim communities, some of them, you know, originally they said, well, we're still Muslims, we don't want to owe allegiance to Medina, but some others also said, we're done, our deal was with Muhammad, and now we're going to go our own way. And some of those other tribes actually said, now we have our own religious leader. And so when the first successor of Muhammad, Khalifa Abu Bakr, prosecuted this apostasy wars, part of the doctrine that he elaborated was apostasy is treason, and then the punishment for treason is death. So that became the punishment for apostasy is death.
To me, it becomes so clear in reading this book that it is really impossible to think of Islam only as a faith. From its very beginnings, it's been a religion and a kind of a social project. Are we getting better in the West at understanding that in order to deal effectively with the Islamic world in a geopolitical context, we need to take this into account?
Well, I think, I hope we're moving in that direction. That's part of why why I wrote this book. You're right. Islam could be thought of as a comparison to other religions, Judaism, Christianity, but it's also a social idea of how to arrange a community, so it's comparable to parliamentary democracy, communism, and other ideologies of that sort, and it's also a civilization, so it could be compared to Chinese civilization, Indian, Western, and other civilizations, and it's a very sort of broad river of human thought and culture, and I hope that in talking about this, I can break down a little bit of the sense of a monolithic, you know, sort of confrontation between two things that are almost each of them homogenous and block-like. Because that's not true of the West. We know that. We live inside it. And it's also not true of Islam.
What would it take to create a history that really merges all of these realities in the most objective way possible?
Well, I think that's an ongoing project that's part of the thing that's happening in the world now, and, you know, no single person is going to do it. And the thing that's happening in the world now is that broad rivers of somewhat distinct civilizations are getting intertwined. And what we're doing right now is we are building a one world, and we are moving towards a global culture. But we don't know what that global culture is. You know, we don't. It's not true that when we finally achieve a global culture, it will be just Western culture having won out over others. It'll be some melange of all these different civilizations. And, you know, I think we have to work that out bit by bit.
Do you think that the West fails to recognize the religious nature of its own view of history, or are we, in fact, more secular in our outlook on past events?
I think we are more secular in our outlook. I think that one of the things that happened in Western history in the wake of the Reformation, it wasn't the intent of the Reformation reformers, but one of the things that happened in the wake of the Reformation is that by some religious revolutionary saying, we have the right to think what we want about our relationship to God, they opened the way to say we have the right to not think about God. We have the right to think about some things without having it be in reference to God. And that's the beginning of the secular tradition that we have in the West. We don't necessarily think that the...
I'm going to have to stop you there because we're out of time. I mean, the new book is called Destiny Disrupted. It's been fascinating. Destiny Disrupted is the book. A lot of great things to consider there. I really appreciate you coming on.
Thanks a lot.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.